Welcome to the Fabric Podcast and the start of a conversation about our place. You know, the earth. Not so much claiming this as our place as much as taking our place in the wonder, protection, and sustaining of this place. In this episode, you'll hear Greg Meyer pull us into the fraught and fragile reality of our place.
When hope can see the future, it is called vision. Something you and I both need right now is vision. A vision of a world that not only embraces all people across racial, economic, educational, regional, linguistic, cultural ability lines, but also a vision for a world that is not only sustainable environmentally, but thriving. It's not new news that there are multiple crises in climate and water and soil and biological diversity and more. What is news is that there is a vision of the world that we hope for, a world of expanding, engendering life, and there is a pathway towards it. At another time, in the midst of another version of the same crises of humanity cutting itself off from what gives it life, Jesus cast a vision to walk towards. The kingdom of heaven, he said, referring not to some otherworldly location, but a fully woven version of this world. The kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field which someone found and hid. Then in his joy, he goes and he sells all that he has and he buys that field. Again, he goes on, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant in search of fine pearls. On finding one pearl of unsurpassed beauty, he went and he sold all that he had and he bought it. The people of Jesus' day knew what he was talking about. They knew the kind of life, the kind of world that this treasure, this pearl was. He'd given them a taste of it, but it was still probably just too far away from their perspective. It was unreachable given the state of their lives and the world that they lived in. So Jesus offered up one more vision to help them see how their hope could happen. The kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed that someone took and sowed in his field. It's the smallest of all the seeds, but when it has grown, it is the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree so that the birds of the air come and make nests in its branches. For the next 4 weeks, we are going on an adventure that will need your vision. We face an uphill battle that we dare not lose and we need not lose. What we seek is not only invaluable and essential, it is possible. We have seeds in our hands. Many have already been planted. I invite you to join me in these next weeks to grow this vision and our pathway towards it together as we discover our place. Our place, you know, this place, the earth. We don't have another place. It is this place or, well, actually, there is no or. This place is our place. We're also going to be talking about our place, meaning our place within this place. Who are we, human beings? And who are you individually in relationship to everything else that we share this planet with? What is our place within it? Today, I want to help us embrace two truths about our place that may sound like our problems, but are actually clues to what we seek. And they are that our place, this planet, is finite and it is one. First, finite. You know, the world is big. It is so big that there is no way of picturing the whole thing at one time. Because it is so big, we treat the world as if it were inexhaustible, unlimited. Since the earliest days of Homo sapiens, an answer to limitations and challenges has been expansion. Just keep moving. As mobile, adaptable creatures who could manipulate their environment, our ancestors discovered that there was nearly nowhere they couldn't make home. So the answer to resistance was to move on, to empty land and settle on it. It took time and it took learning, it took adaptation, but they could do it. The call to go west, young man, go west, was heeded here in the United States until the Pacific Ocean was reached. Then we filled it all up in between, squeezing out indigenous peoples, plant and animal populations, prairies, and forests. I grew up among those forests in the lumbering legacy region of Wisconsin, and I remember reading accounts of the early loggers who thought the expanse of the Northwoods was inexhaustible. But within decades, all old growth was gone. There are innumerable examples of our inability to see how our small bite of something so huge could ever consume it, even be noticeable. Still today, while we know our accumulative impact on the environment is devastating, we let our individual actions slide as inconsequential. We hear about the country-sized islands of plastic swirling in the Pacific Ocean or the oxygen-depleted zones of the Gulf of Mexico due to the fertilizer runoff down the Mississippi, and we want someone to do something about it, but we don't think the plastic bottle or shampoo comes in or the chemicals we put on our lawn make enough difference to bother with. Perhaps evolution made us susceptible to this naivete because of the relative vastness of the world that we were evolving in compared to the impact that we were able to exert individually. But what evolution may have missed, we must rely on wisdom to supply. Many of our ancestors and some peoples yet today, like the indigenous people of our own continent, developed ethics. It developed wisdom that shaped their relationship with the rest of the land and all of its inhabitants, even when their own action didn't seem to make any visible difference. As a society, however, and I can only speak for our Western society of recent generations, we have by and large failed to grasp this. And we've behaved as if the planet was so big and so resilient that our actions were immune from consequences. The planet was ours to do with whatever we wanted. Today it's apparent that this was an illusion. Our numbers and the impact our technology endows us with have taken away the buffer between what we do and what happens to the planet. We can no longer plead ignorance. We are seeing it and we're feeling it. My wife Chris and I spent about 7 years in Papua New Guinea. That's the second largest island in the world, tucked between eastern Australia and the equator down in the Southwest Pacific. The people of this mountainous, temperate rainforest region of the country whom we lived among were pre-contact just 20 years before. Our purpose in being there was to make space for them to make careful, healthy moves in the inevitable cultural and technical change that was upon them. Previously, they had had no written language, no graphic arts, no wheel, and perhaps most importantly, no metal tools. One of the first items traded into the region, even pre-contact, were steel axes. Those axes were a parable for the whole of humanity's collision with the finitude of our planet. You see, until then, the Anga people had to cut back the rainforest to plant gardens and to make space for the villages, but their axes had stone blades. They were true artisans in the making and the use of them, but stone axes aren't that efficient. They're not efficient enough to cut the rainforest faster than it can grow. They didn't have to curb their appetite for clear land, because the rainforest made sure that clearings were always disappearing faster than they could be made. The advent of steel tipped the balance, however. For the first time in their history, they could clear land faster than the rainforest could reclaim it. Kunai, the grassland that fills unforested areas, leaving soil unfit for gardens and devoid of life relative to the rainforest, was expanding. And as their population began to increase with better health care and more food, the ratio of kunai that only supplied roofing material to bush that gave them life was flipping. The world is finite. David Attenborough, the legendary documentarian of our planet, tracks our discovery of this back to our very first glimpses of Earth from space. He says that seeing the totality of our planet and all of humanity in one view made it dawn on at least some people that the Earth is not only finite, but it is in fact tiny. Tiny and lonely and fragile. By the way, please go and watch his film, A Life on Our Planet. At age 93, he calls it his witness statement and his vision for the future. There's a link to it in our podcast description and on our episode page. And by the way, did you know there's an episode page that goes along with every podcast? Yeah, that's linked on the description as well, or you can find it on our website. Okay. Now, living on our limited, finite planet, that can sound pretty scary. And from the perspective of the vision of our place that we have been living with, well, it is scary because it means our planet is running out of all the stuff that we need and want and are using up. But there is a vision that we can have, and it isn't a story of scarcity. It says that the planet is finite and it is a living, growing, creative system. I mean, imagine this. The Earth was once nothing but rock, and with no help from us, it evolved into a teeming, thriving, interwoven fabric of unimaginable variety and complexity of landscapes and minerals and plants and animals, life, deeper and richer than we can possibly fathom. the wonder of a world like that, which is so vast in its ability to become and beget variety and life and beauty, it reminds me of the wonder that the writer of the letter to the Ephesians in the Bible was trying to show us when he wished, well, these are his words, that we might begin to grasp the height and the width and the depth and the length of God's love that surpasses our comprehension. That infinite potential in our finite world is certainly one way of thinking about what the love of God is in the first place. And the potential of that kind of a world, to borrow the next sentence from his letter, is far greater than all we can ask or imagine. The potential of our world is far greater than all you or I can ask or imagine. That is a seed for hope. That is something vision can grow from. Consider this. Since our planet, our place, has all the potential for engendering life as it has demonstrated, then there need be no doubt that its finiteness can be more than enough for us and for all that finds its life here. We just need to know our place. So, yes, the world is finite, but there is another word we need to reckon with. One. Our place, this planet that we live on and must find our role in, is one. Yeah, you know, like one, not two. That's essential, and it's akin to the idea that it is finite. But the point here is that it is one, as in connected, united, together, inseparable. Remember last month we talked about revolutionary love, meaning that there are no strangers? That the idea that we are people as separate, independent of one another, that's an illusion? Reality shows us that we are all connected, not separate, not independent. Whether we can see it or whether we acknowledge it, that doesn't matter. Well, that extends to more than just people. The world is also one. The many components, systems, and beings of the earth are not independent of one another, but are inextricably connected to one another. Our fates are interwoven. What happens to any part, in some way, directly or indirectly, sooner or later, affects us all. We have had what I would call a crisis of language for centuries as we talked about our place in the world. And that's one of the things that keeps us from understanding and claiming this oneness. Even people who try to reclaim a healthy place for human beings on our planet end up talking about humankind and nature, or humanity and creation. Do you hear what's wrong with that? It speaks as if we human beings aren't part of nature, but exist in addition to it. It is us and it, not part of creation, but alongside it. Think about all the ways we objectivize the rest of the planet and how we talk. The land, our lakes and rivers, the hills and forests, they're natural resources. Natural? A buy, but resources? Sure, yeah, they are resources, but is that all they are? Do they only have meaning or value in how they are useful to us? And then there is our tendency to understand everything in economic terms. What is the value of it to us? What would it cost for us to get along without it? Hurricane Katrina, they tell us, cost us $125 billion. So what does that even mean? A ton of CO2 release in the air costs our economy $50. Even if those economics include some value of wildness, of the value of biodiversity and habitat loss, it's still always calculated in terms of the cost to us. Really? Does nothing have value other than its value to us human beings? Do only human beings have intrinsic worth? I mean, face it, the truth is we don't even always extend that value to other human beings. We've got a long ways to go. As long as it is nature and us, God's creation and people, we will struggle to understand our place. Valerie Kaur's continuous wonderings about what she saw that was different or strange from herself was, "You are part of me that I do not yet know." That is not just a good thing to say to other people, but to the other parts of our world as well. Rather than looking at a tree and wondering what it could be used for, or whether it will be beneficial or a problem in your yard, perhaps it's good to wonder and say, "You are part of me I do not yet know," and then seek to understand. The same to the mouse in your basement and even the fungus on the tomato leaves in your garden this summer. It doesn't mean you have to like or preserve everything, but do you dare decide without first knowing them? Do you want to be treated that way? Okay, The world is finite and it is one. Two confessions, two realizations, two horizons for us to walk towards. As I contemplated talking about this subject with you over the past several months, I kept asking myself, why? What's the point of this conversation? There's no shortage of information about our environmental crises. People much more knowledgeable than I are creating films, writing books, delivering lectures, posting on social media, and the same for what to do. There are far more ways of changing your lifestyle, advocating, and helping out that I could possibly know or convey, and the truth is, only you are going to really know what fits you and your situation. So, it isn't a lack of information, it isn't a lack of ideas of what to do, or the world waiting for fabric to break the ice in this conversation that is driving it all. Those ships have sailed. The reason for delving into this is that there are two messages whose place to be heard and held is in a community like we are. A three-stranded community that continually tries to understand ourselves as the weaving of our full lives with one another, including the rest of creation, and the fabric itself, that which is bigger, beyond, beneath, and between us all, what is often called God. The first of those two messages that need to be heard and held in community like we are is about our realization of who we are. We are part of, not apart from, the rest of the world. If sin isn't just doing a wrong thing, but the alienation and separation that occurs because of our wrongdoings, then this notion of being apart from, intrinsically separated from, the rest of creation is at the core of what the Bible is talking about when it talks about our sinfulness, our brokenness. Our apartness alienates us from ourselves and from one another and from God. God, which can be nothing but fully part of all that is. And while being apart from is our brokenness, being part of everything is our forgiveness, is reconciliation, it's love, above all, it's grace, the giftedness of being who God sees you to be, part of, woven into all that is, no exceptions, no exclusions, worthy, loved for no other reason than your belonging, like everything else you are part of. You've heard me speak this truth before. Expect to hear it recited over and over these weeks. We are part of, not apart from. Hold it. Consider it. It is who you are. The second message is about how we move from being apart from to part of. We move from awareness to appreciation to action. The crisis we face needs action. And many people and organizations are trying to move you towards that. How will you do it? How will you decide what to do and what not to do? You can't do everything. Where will you start? If you're like me, there's a lot of guilt and maybe a lot of fear in all this. Guilt about what you aren't doing and fear about what will happen if you don't. Guilt and fear are not good motivators, especially for the deep, lifelong restructuring of our systems and economy and patterns of life that are required. What happens most often is that we jump to action straight out of some new awareness. You know, you hear the news report, the facts, the evidence, you get the mandate to do something, guilt kicks in, driven by fear. What does it feel like inside you when that scenario plays out? And you think about your two or three cars, you see all the plastic containers on your shelves and under your cupboard, you think about how much water you use, consider the impact of producing the meat and the vegetables that you buy. Whether you have been conscious of it or not, you undoubtedly have a physical and emotional and a mental reaction that determines what you do or don't do. And probably, it isn't very comfortable. When we try to move from action, right from that raw awareness, we inevitably go one of two routes. We either bury it away somewhere, somehow, because it just is too much for us. Or we take reactionary, poorly thought out, personally hard to sustain, and therefore short-lived changes. As has been observed many times, fear and guilt are pretty good at making people do something, but the problem with them is you just don't stay afraid and you don't stay feeling guilty forever. It wears off. And as they wear off, the change that they inspire wears off too. And that's not to even mention the fact that the kinds of changes that negative emotions like these inspire are usually not very healthy. And what we tend to do with them to relieve our fear and our guilt is pass them off on other people. And that just spreads the unhealthiness around. There is another way. There is this place between awareness and action that we can step, and it is called appreciation. Appreciation is when you absorb not only what is wrong, but what is possible. You feel the wonder of what it is that you love so much that your motivation for change rises up from within you, from what you love, rather than being opposed from outside you based on what you feel guilty or fearful of. To think back to Valerie Kaur's understanding of revolutionary love and See No Stranger that we talked about in January, appreciation is what keeps the focus on what it is that you love so that you know what to do with your grief and your anger. And that focus of love gives space for joy, joy in the beauty of the world that you're a part of. And that joy not only sustains, but it propels you through the challenges. Appreciation is more than knowledge or awareness. Appreciation is relationship. It is a shift from using our natural resources to seeing them as part of yourself. Maybe a part of yourself you do not yet know, but you welcome and you discover yourself in them. For me, my appreciation, my delight, wonder, and amazement comes from decades of dipping my paddle into the lakes of the Boundary Waters. Not only marveling at what I will see behind the next island or the next point, but what I will learn about myself from being part of the wilderness. My appreciation swells up in me as I look at the stars at night and see a world that's been familiar to me since my childhood. And I feel that awe of being a part of something so big that I don't really matter, but also feeling at the same time as though those stars are telling me that I do. Appreciation bridges the gap between my awareness and my action when I plant a garden each year. I begin to understand a little bit more about how plants grow, where my food comes from, and how, you know, I have to say the word joy-filled I am when I eat the food that I have grown myself. Appreciation for me is knowing the birds and the animals that frequent my home by name and by their behaviors, seeing the world from their eyes, and knowing that I can get a pretty good understanding of the ecology of any geographical location simply by noting which birds are there. What is your story of appreciation of the world? Take time to remember when you paused to wonder, what did it feel like inside you? What did you learn? What did you take away from it? And how did you share what you felt by being a part of the world for those moments? How did you share that with others? Look for opportunities to stop and to pause and take in the world from its point of view this week. That'd be a pretty good practice for all of us to spend some time with. You know, appreciation does one other thing for me. It makes me want to pull others in. Not to guilt or to scare them, but to share this good thing that I love and I treasure being a part of so much. It helps me inspire others and get inspired by them. It moves me to create the web of mutual support that we're all going to need in order to face the challenge of finding our place in this place of ours. Awareness, appreciation, action. We'll be talking more about this in coming weeks as well. This rhythm will help us be effective and healthy as our partnership with the world grows. Now, during these upcoming weeks, what we can do together is to learn our place. Learn to know and appreciate this place that is our planet and to learn our place within it. That means we can face the finiteness of this terrestrial ball we call home and at the same time feel its strength and resilience. It means we can realize that the world is one and we are part of, not apart from that oneness, and at the same time not get stuck on the limitations that that may mean for your lifestyle and mine, but instead feel the opportunities that spring from being part of something so vast, so complex, dynamic, and resilient that there is always more to discover and more to enjoy. So, whether you feel paralyzed by the changes needed to meet what many are calling an existential crisis of our planet's ecosystems, or you are already a driven environmentalist pulling out all the stops to live and to advocate for sustainable lifestyles, you can benefit from pausing to soak in the wonder of this world that you are part of. We can also team up and support one another to discover where possibility and hope are found. Earlier, I talked about this tendency for us to consider our environmentally unsound individual actions as harmless while they accumulate to create devastating results. Well, guess what? That correlation between the individual and the cumulative works both ways. Your seemingly ineffectual efforts at sustainable living also accumulate, and their collective earth-altering consequences can restore our planet's health. What you do makes a difference, because it isn't just you. Remember, the mustard seed is among the smallest of all seeds, but sown, it grows into one of the greatest of shrubs and becomes a tree that the birds of the air come and make nests in, that create more and more life. Yeah. There is a lot of bad news about our planet and our relationship with it out there. I know. And the timeline for change is short. I talk to too many young people and couples who worry about their children, even about having children in the world that they will have given the severity of our environmental crises. Maybe that's you. I, too, wonder about the future that awaits my kids and grandkids. But folks, those are all reasons to not give up hope. They are reasons to face the truth so that we can see what can be done and remember why we want to do it. To embrace this world we are part of, and rather than try to fix it apart from ourselves, learn how to weave ourselves, our future, our hopes into it. Remember, when hope can see the future, it is called vision. Let's craft that vision together.
Thanks for listening. Maybe sharing this podcast will help you start an important conversation with someone in your life. You can find discussion resources and ways to connect on our website, fabricmpls.com. Discovering our place is something we'll need to do together, and that movement toward wholeness and interconnection of self, other people, the natural world, and the divine is how we talk about life woven deeply.